This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of March, and this week the coronavirus outbreak worsened in the United States. 14 people have died as of our Friday taping, and there are more than 200 confirmed cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. President Trump signed an $8.3 billion emergency spending package to respond to the outbreak, and the World Health Organization warned that some nations are not reacting forcefully enough to the crisis. As this crisis has unfolded, I've been closely watching the stock market, and I will tell you why. It's not because the effect on stock prices is the most important part of this epidemic. It's not, by far. It's because stock prices are a forward-looking measure. The health statistics are a backward-looking measure. They tell us how many people have died, which is not that many yet. They tell us how many people have been diagnosed, but that number is likely far under-inclusive because we're not testing enough people. The sharp stock market decline tells us that the collective view of investors is that this thing is going to be a really big problem. And the problem that investors think it's going to be for corporate profits adds up to a human problem. It means deaths, it means job losses, it means disruptions to everyday life, it means big changes to the way Americans go about their days for a substantial period. What the stock market is trying to tell us is that this thing is going to get quite a bit worse before it gets better. How much worse remains an open question, and the White House has been eager to send the message that people should wash their hands and not be too concerned. But community transmission is already a reality in the U.S., especially in the Seattle area, but also in a variety of places around the country. In Washington, D.C., we do have this emergency spending package, but I think I speak for a lot of Americans when I wonder if the government is doing enough to slow the spread of this disease. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Bruning of the New York Times. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
To discuss the coronavirus threat and response, Donald McNeil joins us now. Donald is science correspondent for the New York Times, and over the years, he has reported on swine and bird flu, Ebola, AIDS, SARS, and more. Hello, Donald.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Donald, on Friday morning, Larry Kudlow was on CNBC's, the top economic official in the White House, and like a lot of officials in this administration, he was very sanguine about the effect of this virus. He said the risk of infection to most Americans remains very low. He said too many businesses have been canceling travel and meetings unnecessarily. Has the White House been striking the right pitch here? Is there a case that this is not that big a deal yet? Is that plausible to you?
Everything's wrong. The stock market is a lousy measure of epidemiology. It's bounced up and down. They have no idea what's going on. The White House has got mixed messages. It's as if we were on December 6, 1941, and they were worried that submarine activity in the Pacific was going to affect the stock market, so they tried to say there's nothing there. The really thing you should be doing is looking at the data out of China, looking at the data from other countries, and then seeing where we are in the United States. And right now in the United States, we are in the headless chicken phase of our response. We don't have tests out there, so we don't know how many people have the virus. Once you can figure out how many people have the virus and where they are, you can start doing isolation and quarantine. And if any of these clinical trials going on in China turn out to produce something that's helpful, and we don't know how those trials are going yet, you can save people from death. And all of that's important, but I pay no attention to the stock market on this one. I don't pay much attention to anything coming out of the White House. I trust people like Tony Fauci.
That's Anthony Fauci, who has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the government's infectious disease arm, for nearly 40 years. Donald, do you believe those numbers coming out of China?
Okay. Forget the daily bounces up and downs. I mean, that the reason that the numbers doubled in one day is because they changed the way they diagnosed cases. Rather than waiting for lab results, which they weren't getting at the time because they didn't have fast enough labs, they were using CT scans. Well, when you have a new way of diagnosing cases, you double your cases overnight. And everybody went, oh my God. So what do you think? You know, either it's gotten worse or there was a cover-up before, or maybe the truth is it was just a new diagnostic. But if you look at the trend in China right now, they had 3,600 cases a day at the end of January. They are now down to 140 cases. At the end of January, 31 provinces in China were on red alert. Now 24 of them are down to yellow or green alert. China is getting on top of this. Do we believe the data from China? Well, the WHO was actually in China, in Wuhan, in Sichuan, in Guangdong. But what we know about China is that if there were dead lying in the streets, if there were mobs at all the hospitals, if there were mobs outside the fever clinic, a cell phone video would leak out. We'd know about it. But it's not. It's actually seriously quieting down. And that's an example for the rest of the world. If you can get on top of this epidemic, I mean, a month ago, I thought 10 million Chinese were going to die. Now, I think they're getting on top of it. I didn't expect it, but when facts change, you got to change your opinion.
So are there things that have been done in China that we can and should copy? If you're saying that there's been a success in China, what would learning from that look like in the United States?
Okay. the way you respond is you tell people, don't go to your doctor's office, don't come to the hospital emergency room because you're just going to spread the virus and you're going to infect the doctor if the doctor isn't gowned up to take the test. Instead, what they did in China is you get online, you're asked your symptoms, you're sent to a fever clinic. At the fever clinic, they were completely gowned up and garbed. They were ready, so they were protected. They would take your temperature. They'd ask you about your symptoms. They'd take a quick medical history to see if they, you know, what your exposure was. And then they would whip you through a CT machine. They were doing on machines, they were doing 200 CTs a day. Because if you look at something, now we do one every half hour to an hour right now, but they were using portable CT scanners. They would look at people's lungs. And if you see these bilateral ground glass opacities, it's kind of a shadowiness in both lungs, you got a pretty good chance for a suspect case. Then they would test them. They give them the test. They had the labs right there, so you got your test results in 4 hours, and you weren't allowed to go home and wait for your results. You got them right there, and if you were positive, then you were put immediately into isolation so that you didn't spread it to your family, because 75 to 80% of the cases there were spread within families. You hear about freak things like a taxi driver here or the Diamond Princess, which is a giant super spreader event, but most of it was in families. You want people isolated away from their families, especially if they live in crowded quarters. If you live in a mansion in Westchester and you have your own bathroom in your own room and nobody can comes into the room where the surfaces are covered with the virus, then you're good. But if you're living in a room with eight people in the apartment, you got to get the sick ones out.
Rich, I know you wrote this week basically saying that the White House needs to stop talking about this like it's not that big a deal. Are you seeing messaging out of the White House that is preparing for responses of that nature?
No. I mean, the emphasis obviously has been on accentuating the positive, in part because the president's so obsessed with the stock market. So oftentimes a point of the communication seems to have been to try to convince the stock market everything is fine rather than being reliable and sound on the virus. And a lot of these Trump statements, though, they're like many things he says, that if you really parse them, he's not saying anything. He's sort of emphasizing the optimistic part, but then he says, oh, anything could happen, it could get really bad. But there's clearly been an emphasis on the upside. And then just the question is, you know, I'm very in favor of the travel restrictions, but, you know, as Donald and others have written, what that does, it buys you time, so then you want to take advantage of the time, and at least in this initial interval here, it seems that any time we bought ourselves was kind of wasted because the CDC messed up the initial rounds of tests. They were test kits they were pushing out. Now, I'm not sure exactly why that happened. It seems to have been just CDC is a very effective organization. It seems to have been just haste and a bad mistake. And then on top of it, FDA regulations that crimped private actors stepping up and filling in the gap. Now, that seems now to be taken care of, but you've lost several weeks there.
Donald, what did you make of the CDC, the test kits that went out that didn't work right, and then the delay in doing testing? Have they screwed up here?
They screwed up temporarily. As far as I can tell, it wasn't the design. It was a manufacturing. They started to make it, and some of the reagents turned out to be bad, and they didn't realize it until the state labs were testing them. One alternative would have been to buy the kits that the WHO had ordered from a company in Germany. The other thing would have been possible would be to order up private kits. But you still have to do quality checking and stuff like that because a private company can mess up too. You know, in the opening days of a war, things go wrong. You know, the outcome of World War II was not decided by what happened at Pearl Harbor. So there are goof-ups. And then when you finally get yourself organized and do a good job, you know, people can stop pointing fingers at each other. They can do, you know, after-action reports later. But, you know, we're in action right now, and we need to keep forging ahead until we get things right.
Liz, what have you made of the first 6 or 7 weeks of reaction here?
Yeah, I mean, it's been worrying. It's been difficult, I think, for the average person to get a bead on how panicked they need to be or how concerned maybe. And it's I think, emerged now that most of the worry needs to be about older people, immunocompromised people, and other people who might have difficulty, you know, fending off this kind of illness. And I don't feel like there's been enough emphasis on that. And to the degree there has been, it has worried me to see some young and healthy people say, oh, this isn't a big deal, it's not going to kill me. That concerns me somewhat because, of course, we will have spread in the community with that kind of attitude. And it will kill older and immunocompromised people. And this is an element of American culture, that kind of individualism that I find very hard to stomach in situations like these. And I think if anything has helped the Asian countries that are currently fighting off this coronavirus, China and South Korea, it is that they tend to have less of that kind of way of looking at things and tend to cooperate with the kind of orders they're under.
Yeah, no, that is very true. That, I mean, what China conducted was essentially a people's war on this disease. And 40,000 medical workers from other cities in China went into Wuhan. They knew they might die because doctors had died of the disease, but they volunteered. Some were volunteers and some were sent in by the army. There's no question about it. But people also just came out and volunteered to be food deliverers and volunteered to be fever checkers and volunteered to be, you know, do the infection control stuff. And so there was a giant effort to help Wuhan, and they see themselves as being on the front lines of saving the rest of China from this. And unfortunately, when I see things like, you know, people in Alabama saying, don't let those Americans from the Diamond Princess into our, you know, state, you know, that disturbed me. I thought, here we have a bunch of other Americans. They're coming back. They're sick. They need help. And they're going to be on a military base. So they're not going to be any harm to anybody. And yet people went to their legislators and said, make sure the president promises he doesn't send them here. That is exactly the opposite of the attitude we need. And there are a lot of young people worried. My daughter goes to UCLA, and I was just talking to her, you know, 20 minutes ago saying, don't worry so much, you know, to see if you can find out where these students came from, and don't sit in any room with a table that they've coughed on. But I wouldn't panic. I don't think they need to shut down the whole campus yet. You know, they may get to that, but that may be an overreaction. It depends on whether or not they can get on top of the cases and isolate them.
But there's sort of two aspects of, you know, what the public cooperation will be with a response, right? One is sort of a willingness to accept things like that and get over a fear of the virus when that's necessary for the response. But another is a willingness to have a sufficient fear of the virus and to make changes to one's life that reduce the spread, right? I mean, isn't there a question of the willingness of people to cooperate with social distancing measures?
Yes, yes.
And a couple of weeks ago, when they were talking about should we have a coronavirus czar, some people floated the idea that Scott Gottlieb, Trump's widely respected former FDA commissioner, should be the coronavirus czar. Instead, the president gave that job to Mike Pence. When you look at public comments from Scott Gottlieb over the last couple of weeks, they're much more grave about the nature of this crisis than anything coming out of the administration. This seems to me like a situation where Trump's unwillingness to hear negative messages that he doesn't want to hear is undermining the policy response and quite possibly undermining public health and safety in the United States.
Yeah, so I don't think many people are taking their cues exactly how to respond to this from the president. But there's no doubt he picked Pence because he wanted someone he could trust and someone who could control the messaging to his liking. How much that's actually affected substantively the response, I don't know. And I think it's unlikely it's affected it much. It seems that we have sort of two tiers. One, people are panicked. And, you know, is it really called for in any rational response to this just to cancel your flight somewhere to Chicago? You know, it seems to be happening, and the airlines are really heavily hit. At the same time, it seems like it's going to take us a long time to get to where Donald was saying China was, where you have special fever clinics, and you got tests right on site, and you're not leaving the clinic until, you know what your test is. So on the one hand, we have an overreaction, I think, generally in our society. At the same time, we probably have an underreaction in terms of these really specific measures that you want really where the likelihood of spread is and where you might actually have sick people.
Liz, this seems like a thing that, you know, creates problems when you're trying to coordinate in an environment of broadly low social trust in a lot of places.
Yeah, I remember when we were dealing with H1N1, that outbreak, swine flu. There were, the vaccine for that disease did eventually emerge. And I remember reading that they had enormously high voluntary uptake on that vaccine in the Nordic countries. Now, that's possibly because those were free vaccines there. But in the United States, it wasn't like it was prohibitively expensive to get it. It was just that people felt like if they weren't at risk, they didn't want to go get a flu shot. They're mistrustful of government invitations or directions to get shots. And so we had, relatively low uptake. And that has to do with social trust and cohesion. The United States does not cultivate that. And we're possibly at a low, an all-time low at the moment with the conditions on the ground. So I sincerely hope that doesn't prove to be, our undoing, because the people that it would hurt the most are, of course, our most vulnerable members of society, right? Elderly people, people who are sick, people in chemotherapy, people who have HIV and AIDS. And I hope we will be able to band together to protect those
people.
Can I ask
Donald something about just how seriously we should be taking this? So there's a school of thought, it's the flu. It's just the flu. And how I understand that argument and its strengths and its flaws is, one, yes, this most people aren't going to be harmed by this any more than they would by the flu. Yes, it's going to hurt it's most dangerous to the people who are already at most risk for the flu. But one, it's a novel thing. There's no immunity that anyone has against it. Two, it's just new, so you have to be worried about it. Three, could be highly contagious. Four, it could be even more dangerous or appears to be even more dangerous for the at-risk populations than the flu we get in the typical flu season.
Okay. There's a lot of context. We will not know the real case fatality rate for this disease until 2 years is up, because this will circle the world like flu. And the case fatality rate in New York City, where you have intensive care, is going to be totally different from the case mortality rate in Africa, where you don't. So a lot more people are going to die. We know this flu kills people. We know that when you segregate out in the early days, look at the first 45,000 patients in China, 2.3% of them died. And I did a very scary podcast for the New York Times saying that's roughly the same death rate as the 1918 flu. So if this is uncontrollable, if the vaccine doesn't happen, if the clinical trials of the antiviral drugs that they're trying in China don't work, we could see something akin to 1918. I no longer think that. When the new data comes out, you got to change your mind. What I see now is that this virus is less transmissible than flu is. So if you do a really good response, you can get on top of it, quarantine the cases early. One of the things to do in China is that they went from symptoms to hospitalization for 15 days in Wuhan to symptoms to isolation in 2 to 3 days. All right. So that means 13 days of people that aren't not wandering around infecting others. That dramatically drops your, quote, R-naught. So everybody argues about R-naught. Everybody argues about case fatality rates. We don't know, and those are all depend on circumstances. 3 days ago, we had a 7% fatality rate in this country because we had 127 cases and 9 of them were dead. So you do the math and you realize, oh my God. But that doesn't mean it's going to kill us all. It means you happen to pick up the first cases when you find dead bodies and you test them. That's not the way to gauge an epidemic's final result. So don't panic. Watch the data.
Let's leave that there. Donald McNeil, science correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times to talk about Super Tuesday. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. So I feel vindicated. I spent the summer and fall telling people that Joe Biden was the front runner and they should stop acting like he was going to fall apart at any moment, that he was probably going to be the Democratic nominee. I will admit things got a little hairy in Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada. Mike Bloomberg was knocking at the door with hundreds of millions of dollars in ads, and I came to question my own call. But on Saturday, Joe Biden blew everyone out of the water in South Carolina, winning by nearly 30 points. And then he romped on Super Tuesday, running up huge margins in the South, taking surprise wins in Texas and in the North, in Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, the latter with a strong assist from Amy Klobuchar, who endorsed Biden the day before the vote alongside Pete Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke. The institutional party did eventually coalesce around Joe, but so did the voters. The core of Biden's wins was overwhelming black support, but he couldn't have gotten where he did without strong support from white voters, too. In many of the states, he won the white working class vote, even. Biden's weakest states were in the West, but I think that's a little bit misleading because California, Colorado, and Utah are all states with heavy mail-in voting, where a huge fraction of votes were cast before Biden's surge in the last few days of the campaign. So Biden doesn't need to bounce upward from his performance in those states. He has already bounced upward. He leaves Super Tuesday with a material delegate lead that seems likely to keep growing over upcoming contests in states like Michigan, Illinois, Florida, and Georgia. And those will be two-way contests, with Mike Bloomberg and Elizabeth Warren having quit the race after weak showings on Super Tuesday. So how did all of this happen? And am I wrong to think that Biden's about to seal this whole thing up in a couple of weeks? To discuss that, we're joined now by Ezra Klein. Ezra is the editor-at-large and founder of Vox.com, which is a sister publication to my employer, New York Magazine. He's also host of The Ezra Klein Show, and his first book, Why We're Polarized, was published this winter. Hi, Ezra.
Happy to be here.
So I actually want to start with Liz. I will turn to you, Ezra, in a second. Liz, what happened here? We were discussing as recently as a few days ago the limpness of Stop Bernie efforts. They were caught up in infighting among moderates. It wasn't clear that party insiders could coalesce around one candidate, and it didn't look like voters would listen to them even if they did. And then all of a sudden, that happened. What do you make of the voters swarming to Joe?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it, you know, has to do with the elements of the narrative that took place right before Super Tuesday that you listed. So Amy Klobuchar dropped out and Pete Buttigieg dropped out, and they threw their support immediately and emphatically behind Biden, especially for their for Amy's home state. And then for their supporters, and Buttigieg had been doing all right, right, in those early primary states. He had some support. And, you know, so their supporters, I think, took that seriously as an indication that, you know, it's time to buckle down and slow Bernie, make sure that we don't wind up with a left-wing nominee. And I think that for... Well, let me put it this way. In the era that we're in politically, it doesn't seem to work to try to judge what's going on by like reading data about voters, polls, and then projecting from there in a kind of scientific way. We're in a very moody political era. And I have found that the most accurate indicator tends to just kind of be the smell in the air. And to me, you know what I mean? But to me, the smell in the air is that people are freaked out by the idea of a long and bruising primary that could split the party. We might have already crossed the Rubicon on that. And they don't want to see whoever the nominee is wound up sunk by splitting the vote in that way. And so I think there was just an urgency among a lot of moderate voters to try to get this over with, get an ordinary, normal-feeling Democrat in there, and get rid of Trump.
Ezra, I mean, I think that all sounds right, but you could have imagined a world in which the party ended up coalescing around Bernie. And I mean, Republicans, many of whom had big objections to Donald Trump through most of the 2016 primary election, ended up coalescing around Trump for exactly the reasons that Liz describes there. They didn't want a contested convention. They wanted certainty in how they were going to go into the general election. So what do you make of this appearing to being ending with coalescing around Biden, not Bernie?
So a couple things here. So one, at this point in 2016, there was no party coalescence around Trump. There were Republican voters moving towards Trump, but Trump did terribly in endorsements and other kind of traditional indicators of where the party is going. He was able to do basically a hostile takeover of the Republican Party and its institutions, and that's not something you're seeing here. What remains fascinating to me about this particular primary is that Joe Biden, for all of his institutional advantages, has not had a very strong party-decides dynamic until literally over the past week. The dropping out of Klobuchar, of Pete Buttigieg, the endorsement of Beto O'Rourke, the endorsement of Harry Reid before South Carolina, the endorsement of Jim Clyburn, those were big. But if you compare this to what happened for, say, Al Gore in 2000 or Hillary Clinton in 2016, they're quite small, right? It's not like Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, President Barack Obama, these folks were coming out for Biden. So he was operating a little bit more on his own. The other thing, though, that was really striking to me and that I think should make a lot of pundits take a moment and step back is that what Biden did on Super Tuesday was he won a high turnout election. And I think that all of us who've been watching him, what we understood about him or was thought to be understood about him was that Joe Biden might be regarded by some people as a safe choice, but what he's not going to do is mobilize voters. If there's going to be a high turnout election, it's going to favor Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or just someone else who's a exciting, enthusiasm-oriented candidate. But instead, there was a flood of entrants into the Democratic primary. And according to the Washington Post numbers, Joe Biden won 60% of new voters in the Democratic primary. So something about, I think, our intuitions about what is driving turnout this year and what is motivating voters is being proven wrong right now. I think Biden in particular has a lot of weaknesses that are very salient to people in the media. He's not that ideological, which a lot of us are. He is not a very good speaker, which if you have become a professional media communicator in your life, you care about that a lot. But whatever connection he had with the electorate or whatever the electorate is feeling that he became a vessel for was pretty strong and led to him winning a kind of victory that is very much not the kind that I would have expected he would win, even if you had told me he was going to take victory on Super Tuesday.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, it seems to me if he's such a weak candidate, how did he manage to do this comeback with very little money, having been written off in a lot of ways by people, and frankly, without obvious talents in the specific areas that Ezra describes there? He's not the best speaker on the stump, yeah. But it seems to me he's providing something that people want, which is the idea that things can be normal again.
First of all, I mean, this is the most extraordinary political comeback of our lifetimes. In 2004 and 2008, you had big comebacks of establishment frontrunners John Kerry in 2004 and McCain in 2008. But both of those guys were left for dead and came back before voting started. But to finish fourth in Iowa and fifth in New Hampshire and a distant second in Nevada, and then come back within, you know, 10 days or whatever it was and sweep the country is just extraordinary. And my subjective sense, you know, I can't prove this, was that it was more Jim Clyburn and the African-American vote in South Carolina deciding to hold up Joe Biden rather than Joe Biden doing anything extraordinary to win them. And then the party kind of picking up the baton from there with this incredibly coordinated series of endorsements. But I think the key insights that Biden had were, one, that this that the electorate wasn't as left as everyone else thought at the beginning. And two, in the early contest, African-Americans hadn't spoken, and he had a connection to them that was going to endure. I was very skeptical of that. I was skeptical of Biden all along. I certainly didn't think there was any way he could survive these disastrously poor finishes in Iowa and New Hampshire. But he did, and he has a coalition that looks pretty strong. African-Americans, suburban voters, working-class voters now, he seems equally strong with Bernie there. And like Bernie just basically has a problem that he doesn't have enough votes. You know, he's expanded his coalition from 16 among Latinos, which he really worked, which is a great thing, but hasn't really expanded at all among African-Americans, and certainly not African-Americans who aren't very young. And as I mentioned, the working class vote is not there the way it was in 16 for him. And he doesn't have the suburban appeal that Joe Biden does. Yeah. So this led to a disaster on Super Tuesday.
Liz, does this cause you to reevaluate at all your view that Bernie is the stronger general election candidate than Joe Biden? I mean, as Ezra noted, the vaunted turnout that Sanders was supposed to produce did not appear. It seems to be Biden is the one who has actually been able to activate a lot of people to get out and vote in this race. I mean, isn't that a good sign about Biden as a general election candidate?
But I don't think they're getting out to vote because Joe Biden is such an exciting candidate, right? They're trying to vote for the normalcy candidate. And I think against Trump, even Sanders would be able to pull these voters who are so motivated to get Trump out of office. I wrote a column this week recommending that Bernie spend more time emphasizing the aspects of his platform that don't necessarily have to be read as radical or revolutionary. They're, in fact, you know, pretty ordinary in most of the world and are already things that exist in different degrees here in the United States, like parental leave, like child care benefits. You know, we all have a little bit of that, or many of us have a little bit of that. Actually, quite a few of us don't have any parental leave, unfortunately. But we know of those concepts, and they're not too radical. And all we're saying is we could have some more, and everyone could have it. And, you know, worldwide, not an unusual thing. So, I mean, I think there's something to be said for that. But I also think that, you know, it just appears that quite a lot of people have at the top of their priority list, you know, feeling okay again. And I think that Bernie is a change candidate. And, you know, I still have hope. I'm not completely throwing in the towel. I don't think anybody should. But, you know, it may be the case that that's more difficult this time around.
Ezra, what do you make of that frame about, you know, the it being about which policies a candidate emphasizes? I mean, it seems to me that the case in your book is that, you know, this primary is actually, or and elections in general, are less about policy than we tend to think about them being in the media.
I don't think there's any doubt of that, but I will say, and we can talk about the broader case of the book, that's, I think, more applicable to a general election than a primary election. In the general election, you have these very strong currents of polarization where the two parties are very different from each other, and there are probably not that many voters who would vote for Joe Biden and wouldn't vote for Bernie Sanders. Probably a couple, right? I mean, I come from Orange County. It's a center-right place. It elected Katie Porter as the first Democrat it ever sent in my home district to the House, and so I can think of voters there who might look at a Trump Bernie race and say, well, on the one hand, I don't like Trump. And on the other hand, CNBC keeps telling me stocks are going to collapse if Bernie gets elected. And so I don't know exactly what to do. So I'm not saying there are no voters like that. But I think in the most case, what you're seeing is going to be a Democrat versus Republican breakdown. I actually think with Bernie, one of the things that happened here was a genuine strategic mistake over the past couple of weeks. I think he's run in many ways an excellent campaign, but there is a very deep core in his DNA about being hostile to the Democratic establishment, an insurgent trying to change the Democratic Party. And one of the things that he really needed to do as he became the front runner after he won, or tied, depending how you think about it, Iowa, but then won New Hampshire, won Nevada, is begin to get some of those inside endorsements. It would be a signal to people who might be wavering on him. So he wasn't going to get Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg. But I could imagine a world where if he had been doing the work, he could have gotten, you know, maybe a Tammy Baldwin, a Sherrod Brown. Gavin Newsom had endorsed Joe Biden earlier, but Gavin Newsom is a very liberal guy. He's a Medicare for All supporter, et cetera. That kind of inside political game is something Sanders has not traditionally been that good at. And I think you saw the weakness of it here. Again, those of us who cover politics and follow these candidates on the trail and watch every single debate, we very heavily emphasize the public-facing campaign skills of giving speeches, of giving interviews, of winning debates. But there are all these other things that go into both campaigning and a presidency, these sort of more coalitional dynamics. Hillary Clinton was very good at them in 2016. Joe Biden traditionally in his own political career has been very good at them. That's why he was an effective legislator, you know, no matter what you think of the things he was actually legislating. And that was really the skill he brought to bear here right at the end. There are a lot of Democrats who want to be Trump and were looking for signals of who could do it. And I do wonder about the alternative history where Bernie Sanders and the people around him were able to begin racking up what the Obama campaign in 2008 used to call permission structure, right? They recognized people might be nervous about voting for the first African-American president. And so they began to roll out these endorsements that were designed to make people who might be wavering feel comfortable. I think that is the step the Bernie Sanders campaign missed, and particularly to mount a comeback right now, one they would need to get back. After he'd had that heart attack, he got endorsements from, among others, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which was a really reassuring sign to people that his campaign was still going. It had life in it. People were going to keep jumping on the bandwagon, and it really saved it at a key moment. I don't think they realized that there was still not a saving of the campaign to do, but a securing of the gains they had made. And if they're going to be able to, I think, to clamber back from where they are, they need to begin bringing some people off of the sidelines who maybe believe Joe Biden is a risky candidate. I do think there's reason to believe he is risky, and see Bernie Sanders as a better option. Sanders needs some signals that are outside of his current campaign to get those voters over to him again.
I think, Liz and Ezra, these are great points, but let me defend Bernie's theory of the case, which had a very good chance of working. It was working. And I think what happened with this Biden sweep, probably, I don't know, it had like a 10 or 20% chance of working. And what the Bernie theory was, I'm going to have an impassioned minority, an impassioned plurality, and I'm going to win this nomination at the outset with like 30% of the vote. And there was a good, very good chance of that working. You know, if Biden hadn't been as strong in South Carolina and there hadn't been this consolidation at the end, and the race just looked in Super Tuesday the way it did 4 days prior to voting, Bernie, it would have worked for Bernie. And then he could have done, you know, the sort of consolidation and the permission endorsements and all that from a position of strength as the front runner.
I don't know. I mean, I think that strategy could well have worked to get a plurality of delegates if the race had remained very fragmented. But the Democrats have very different delegate rules than the Republicans did. The strategy that Donald Trump ran is not as good a strategy on the Democratic side because it won't get you over 50% of the delegates. And then sooner or later, Bernie was going to face this test of having to act like a party insider, having to try to build coalitions, whether among voters, which he has been failing to right now, or among delegates, saying, you know, I have 44% of the pledged delegates, and you should make me the nominee. And Liz, as I've been watching, it seems like it finally, after Super Tuesday, it dawned on Bernie that they needed to be doing this. And they rolled out the ad with him and Barack Obama, with Barack Obama praising him. Bernie's been talking about how he's actually part of Senate leadership, and he's a team player. And there seems to be a top-down effort to try to be nicer. But it just feels a day late and a dollar short to me that really, you know, coalition building inside the party is just not what something that he naturally does. And it was going to be something he would need to do sooner or later if he was going to be the nominee.
Well, and making the point that the Democratic Party has a lot of problems is a worthwhile thing. And it's been a part of Bernie's career. But I just don't think it's something that Democratic voters want to hear right now. I think the response to that is like, yes, well, there may be issues in the Democratic Party, but look at Trump, look at the Republicans, look at everything we've suffered under this administration, especially refugees and migrants who've come to the United States, Dreamers and so forth. You know, how can you say that the Democratic Party is the institution we need to be railing against? I think that there's a lot of that going on. And I mean, you have to give Bernie this. The guy is consistent. Whether or not it's like politically wise or advisable, he's not listening to focus groups. I don't even think he's like putting a finger to the wind, right? He's only putting out messages that he actually fully agrees with. And that creates some respect in the fact that, you know the guy is honest, because sometimes this is like a little bit counterproductive for his purposes. But at the same time, if you have a consistent message, history changes. And sometimes a consistent message is going to hit and sometimes it's not. And so the Trump years, I think, put him in a difficult situation.
Can we talk a little bit about the candidates who dropped out this week? Elizabeth Warren, Mike Bloomberg. I mean, Ezra, you're the author of the case for Elizabeth Warren for Vox. She was trying to position herself as the compromise candidate between Biden and Bernie. It clearly didn't work at all. What went wrong for her?
I don't think that she ever did a real effort. Sorry, I'm saying this inarticulately. I don't think she did effectively position herself as a compromise candidate. And I think this goes way back into the primary. Right towards the end, she's beginning to make some speeches that very few people heard, suggesting that she could be a unity candidate. But if you go back to the way her team theorized of this campaign, there was almost, you could date it, there was almost a moment in the primary where they decided that their competition was with Bernie Sanders for voters on the left. And it was right at that moment when she decided to fully go in on Medicare for All. Before that, she had been very notably somebody who, if you asked her the question of, do you support Medicare for All, she would say, I support many different pathways on healthcare, which is a view a lot of different Democrats have, that there are a lot of ways to do this. Medicare for All will be better than what we have. The public option plans will be better than what we have. And the question is, what can actually pass? Warren and her team made a sort of no enemies to our left decision. And so instead of staking out a candidacy, and not just that, but a message that was in between the Bernie Sanders democratic socialism, the Democratic Party is in some ways the problem, capitalism itself is in some ways a problem, and the Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar message of the system works, you know, reasonably well. We can get it to work better. Capitalism is a good system that needs to be tweaked. You need some redistribution. That she had always had this potential message, which is in between them, of, you know, really trying to save capitalism from the capitalists. She used to talk about being a capitalist to her bones. She had a lot of different plans of a lot of different ways. Her big idea going way back in her own, not just candidacy, but career, is making markets work and regulating them in a very different way. So she could have had a much more distinctive message, but instead she began fighting on Sanders' ground. She had plans that were similar to his, in some cases, in fact, early on things like student debt or wealth taxes a little bit to his left. And so she was in a competition with him for the same voters and did not end up seeming to a lot of the folks looking for a more moderate candidate like someone for them. So I think that in retrospect, her campaign made some mistakes. By the same token, and as you know, I wrote that piece for Vox, I think she's an incredibly impressive candidate, an incredibly impressive person. I do think there was an element of misogyny, not just in how she was treated, but in the kinds of appeals she felt she had to make and the kinds of specificity and constant demonstrations of competence that she felt she had to perform. And so, like a lot of women candidates, I think there's a little bit of a double bind there. But, you know, that isn't to say she ran a perfect campaign. And I think that given the way she'd positioned herself from the beginning, becoming or emerging as a compromise candidate was always going to be hard. Yeah, you wonder sometimes if a Kamala Harris or even a Cory Booker wishes they had stayed in a little bit longer, because in some ways I think they were better positioned for that kind of move.
And Liz, you were saying a couple of weeks ago that you wouldn't vote for Mike Bloomberg under any circumstances. I assume you're pleased that that's going to be only an academic question.
Yeah. Rip Mike Bloomberg. Thanks for your time. Good to see him go. Now I can put him back on the list of stuff I don't have to worry about because I don't live in New York.
it was interesting, though, how basically it seemed like Elizabeth Warren destroyed him, but it was almost like the Chris Christie, Marco Rubio murder-suicide thing from 4 years earlier, that the key beneficiary was Joe Biden, that, you know, Bloomberg was the pretender to, here, I'm the viable moderate candidate, and people realized, oh, he's not, so I guess we have to go with Biden.
Right. It was something like that. And also, I mean, the field was simply narrowing. That debate was extraordinarily tense for a lot of reasons. And I'm not sure I can imagine at that point in the race a debate having been, you know, any other way. And I think that, you know, another aspect of Democratic voters being so tired of Trump is, like I said earlier, being very resistant to this idea of a long, ongoing, dragged out primary with a lot of mudslinging. I don't think anybody wanted that this time around. And so seeing that kind of punctuated, I think, was something a lot of voters were happy with. I was sad to see Elizabeth Warren go, certainly happy to see Bloomberg go.
I imagine if he had this power, he'd give back American Samoa, because it makes it even more ridiculous and embarrassing that he spent all this money and actually won American Samoa rather than not winning anything.
I've been talking with Liz Bruning of the New York Times, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Ezra Klein of Vox. We will be back to talk about why we're polarized. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. And our special guest is Ezra Klein, editor-at-large at Vox and author of the new book, Why We're Polarized. Ezra, I'd like to talk about your book and what it tells us about the campaign that we're about to have. I mean, assuming that Joe Biden continues to ride this wave and ends up being the Democratic nominee, I mean, it feels like, to me, like nominating Joe Biden is an effort to push back against polarization in the U.S., basically picking the most broadly acceptable candidate you could come up with in the party, someone who has who part of his key appeal is supposed to be that he can pick off swing voters who have become alienated to the Republican Party in affluent suburbs while retaining more of the working class white voters than a candidate like Elizabeth Warren might. And so I guess, do you buy that? Is this a move to push back on polarization by the Democratic Party, by the Democratic coalition? Or is this going to be an election that is just as polarized as some we've seen in the past?
I think both. And so I think there are two big points in my book that are applicable to this election. And one of them is that polarization makes candidate quality and ideology somewhat less important, but it makes the question of counter-mobilization very important. And then number two, the Democratic Party consistently has a very different internal structure and external task than the Republican Party in ways that I think we don't emphasize or take seriously enough when we tend to handicap elections. So let me start with the first one, which is when the parties are this different, when they are this different ideologically, this different demographically, we see that in general, if you can win your party's nomination, you are guaranteed the votes at the presidential level of, like, let's call it about 45%. You start right there. And from then, it's what you can add on. But you don't have the kind of system you did 30 years ago or 50 years ago, where if you nominated a George McGovern or a Barry Goldwater, you could just lose in a landslide. People are very locked in place, not just by partisanship, but by negative partisanship, which is one reason I was less concerned than other folks were about Bernie Sanders' electability, because in the same way that Donald Trump was able to consolidate Republican support, despite having been unusual for a Republican candidate, Bernie Sanders, who is a much more typical Democrat comparatively, given that he's been a pretty loyal party, not member, but ally for many, many years, I think was going to do just fine. But what you do see there is that even if we have seen studies suggesting that the long-term penalty for nominating a more ideologically outside candidate is going down, it's still there. And the particular way it's still there is if you nominate somebody who is considered somewhat outside the bounds, what you see is more mobilization on the other side. It doesn't really activate your side the way people often think it would. And I think we're seeing that a little bit with Bernie Sanders, where he's not bringing in a whole lot of new voters, but he's doing just fine as a Democrat. He's running a very strong kind of Democratic campaign. And if you didn't know he was a socialist from Vermont, et cetera, you wouldn't see anything unusual about it. But he is potentially a good villain for the right, right? Socialism and Fidel Castro and Cuba and the Soviet Union. And you can see some of that spinning up, very high tax increases. What Joe Biden is an effort to dampen that. Joe Biden frames himself as somebody who could cut down on polarization. I don't think that's ultimately going to be true. Polarization has been able to absorb much more talented candidates than Joe Biden. And if he wins the presidency, he will become enemy number one. He even sometimes admits this as somebody who used to have a lot of good relationships with Senate Republicans before they decided to try to investigate him and his son. So the idea that he will end polarization, even as he makes that argument sometimes, is wrong. On the other hand, there is an argument that Donald Trump is an extraordinarily mobilizing figure for Democrats, and Joe Biden is not as mobilizing a figure for Republicans. Republicans tend to be older, whiter. They've seen him for a very long time. He's not a hugely woke candidate. And so it's not that he's going to have a huge change in dynamics, but I know Trump voters who just don't find Joe Biden that scary. So that's one piece of it. But the other thing that I think we always have to keep in mind is that you cannot perform as a Democrat the way Donald Trump did and win. He won 46.1% 20% of the vote in 2016. If a Democrat won that much, they would get beaten in a landslide. Similarly, to win the Senate, to retain control of the House, Democrats have to win in just what are literally definitionally center-right districts because of the geographic lean of those places electorally. So Joe Biden is an effort, I think, to deal with that reality, at least in a very certain way. If the idea of Bernie Sanders was you deal with that reality by having a pure candidate who turns out people maybe feel alienated from the process, and that hasn't totally panned out yet. The idea of Joe Biden is you put out a candidate who doesn't mobilize Republicans that much, who's broadly acceptable in a lot of places, and at least in the current situation, seems like the candidate who the Democratic candidates who are successful in those states actually wants. You saw people like Gretchen Whitmer, the Democratic governor of Michigan, endorsing Biden. One of the arguments from him has always been that the candidates who run in Wisconsin and Michigan and these places seem to have a preference for a presidential figurehead like Biden, who is a little bit less mobilizing to Republicans in their districts. And so to the extent there's an electability case for Biden, it's that, because he just creates a little bit more space for Democrats to run a generic Democratic campaign and keep Trump as the central mobilizing figure.
Yeah, and Rich, I mean, that's a case that Biden explicitly makes, that if you want a progressive agenda enacted in Washington, nominate the person who will bring the largest number of Democratic winners in Senate races. And what we've seen in this past week, as it has come to look like Joe Biden's going to be the nominee, Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, who's a Democrat, decided to run for the Senate. We'll try to pick that seat up for Democrats. Colin Peterson, the Democrat who represents the most Republican district held by any Democrat in the House of Representatives, he represents sort of northwestern Minnesota, he's surprisingly going to seek re-election. He thinks he can hold on to that seat. So, you know, I think we came into this cycle thinking that Republicans had a map that was favorable enough that they were very unlikely to lose the Senate. And so I think that's, you know, when you look at the Joe Biden theory of social change, it's starting to look more plausible. Maybe he can, you know, he can build a broad enough coalition that he not only wins, but that he gets a majority in both houses of Congress. And then being made public enemy number one by Republicans in Congress is maybe not as important as it otherwise would be.
Yeah. So what Ezra was outlining, which was my old theory, which is, if you want to be elected president, don't be hated by the other side and do things to take the edge off George W. Bush, compassionate conservatism, Barack Obama. You know, there's no red America, no blue America. And then Trump kind of blew that theory out of the water, at least in 2016. But Ezra's right. And a big advantage of the Biden candidacy, now Trump's going to, you know, work at this to reverse this, is, you know, Republicans may be kind of contemptuous at a certain level, snarky about him, but they don't hate him the way they did Hillary, and have been primed to hate Hillary for decades, right? And no one's had that feeling about Joe Biden. And this, your point, Josh, this is why, to me, you know, if I'm on the left, if I'm not, you know, I wouldn't have wanted the purist Bernie Sanders and take the risk to do that, because I would think a Biden or a Buttigieg wouldn't be as risky electorally. And then once they got in there, especially on this issue of healthcare, they're going to do the left most plausible healthcare program they can. And that's not Medicare for all. It's just not. It's some salami slice increment toward that goal, which, as I've said before, you know, last 50 years, that approach has served the Democrats very well, because you advance your agenda a little bit, don't blow yourself up, and then whatever it is you're done is never going to be reversed. And this would have been the dynamic even if Bernie had been elected president and tried to do Medicare for all. He inevitably would have gotten beaten back and had to do his own version of a salami slice approach.
Liz, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, that all makes sense. I would hope that at some point, I know. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, in my life, I'm going to have to make a lot of hard decisions about having kids because I can't afford them. And I have a really good job. And I hate that. And I hate it for all of the people who are in my position. And so many of my young friends are in this exact same position, right? Or worse, many of them much worse. They make a lot less money. A lot of them have overwhelming student debt. And they're going to have that for a long time. And they're putting off childbearing because it's very expensive. It's medically very expensive. It disrupts your work. It can make your workplace unhappy with you. A lot of people don't have leave or paid leave, and they know that the cost of childcare, especially in these urban centers where a lot of millennials work, is extremely onerous, and they're putting it off, and some of them will put it off until it's not possible for them anymore, and some of them will put it off until doing it requires extremely expensive medical interventions that are not covered by insurance, and they will be right back in the same financial position they're in now. And some people are going to go ahead and brave it, and have a really difficult go of it. And I see other countries in the world where it doesn't have to be like that, and I just wish that could be us.
Well, so Ezra, in your book, you make some recommendations that are intended to overcome polarization. It seems to me are intended to overcome the difficulty of policymaking, that if we're going to be so polarized, it has to be easier to change policy so that if you have a bare majority and win an election, that gives you control over public policy. So doing things like getting rid of the filibuster in the Senate, for example. And I guess, you know, does that change this calculus here? Would it make more sense to nominate somebody like Bernie Sanders if you were really going to be able to reach for the moon on that? And is that necessarily desirable? If the electorate's more polarized, doesn't ease of policymaking just mean it's more likely that policy will swing farther away from what the median voter wants? Isn't it possible that this is exactly the environment where we want it to be difficult to pass laws?
Right. So a few things here. One of the arguments my book makes, which I think is a little bit different than what people might expect it to make, is that polarization itself, the simple fact that there's disagreement sorted between the two parties, is not the problem. The problem is the way polarization acts with our particular political system, which is structured very unusually, internationally unusually, such that it is a ton of veto points. It encourages divided government that you then add on things like filibusters and the House committee system and Supreme Court's judicial review. And it requires very high levels of consensus to govern. And those high levels of consensus between the parties become functionally impossible when the parties are this polarized. And one reason I don't think that is actually a better thing is that it does not ease polarization. It exacerbates it. The worst part of polarization is a part where you're endlessly stuck arguing over a problem, but you can't solve it. So Obamacare is just, if you look at the polling, a less polarizing policy today than it was when it passed. It has 54 or 55% approval. I mean, if you look at something like Medicare or Medicaid, you see an even more amplified version of that. So I think being able to actually govern is important. So I argue for democratization, small d democratization, doing away with things like the Electoral College, doing away with things like the filibuster. I'm very much in agreement with Liz. I think that there are things that we need to do in this country and things that people would be really happy if we were able to do in this country that we've not been able to do. And the central reason we've not been able to do them isn't even the structure of American public opinion, though sometimes that has been an issue, but it is a structure of our institutions. The fact that when a party that is running on these things gets power, they cannot actually wield that power to do this. And then the public can decide, do they like the universal child care program that has emerged or not, and then vote based on that argument. One of the things that was frustrating to me about the way the Democratic primary has gone is there's been a tremendous amount of fantasy policymaking where it's as if the only important thing is the difference between the imaginary agendas of the different candidates as opposed to more of a focus on how they're going to get any of this done. One place I'm very critical of Joe Biden is that he is so institutionalist in his approach to the U.S. Senate. I don't think there's any chance he'll do things like get rid of the filibuster or really expand the use of the budget reconciliation process that would be necessary to make his agenda plausible. I will say by the same token, Bernie Sanders, for all of his revolutionary tendencies, he was a supporter of the filibuster. He said, with the exception of Medicare for All, where he wanted to expand budget reconciliation in a very complicated way, that his line was, I'm not crazy about getting rid of the filibuster, because he's been in the Senate for a long time. He has used the filibuster very effectively. People who've been in the Senate for a long time tend to get a little bit captured by the institution. But I think a lot of Democrats, not just those two, but Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, et cetera, Amy Klobuchar is another, they have become sort of bred into being more comfortable with the problems of paralysis than the problems potentially of governance. And I think on both sides of the aisle, a country where what happens is the public elects leaders. Those leaders are able to implement for the most part their agendas and solve the problems they promised to solve. And then the public can make a decision about whether or not they like the way those problems are solved and then vote those people back in or vote them out is just a much better way to run a railroad. So I wish whoever would get in, almost from whatever party, would begin to prioritize both democratizing American governance so that majorities are able to express themselves into power and then making it more easy for majorities to govern once they are in power so that we can get out of just arguing about why things didn't happen and move into a phase in American governance where things happen and then the public is able to decide, well, did they like that or did they hate it?
Ezra Klein is the editor-at-large and founder at Vox. His book is called Why We're Polarized. Ezra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Early voting is convenient for people, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea. As we saw on Super Tuesday, the downside of early voting is that it gets people to lock in their votes before they know all the facts. Like in this case, that Joe Biden wasn't dead, but very much alive and consolidating party support. It's a much better idea to have people vote when they have all the information, including which candidates are viable or not.
Liz Brunig, what's on your mind?
With coronavirus spreading, a lot of people are very nervous. And in extremely anxious periods like this, people will look for reasons to relax. I understand that. Since it's become clear that coronavirus is primarily dangerous, that is, fatal to older people, I've heard a lot of younger people say, well, then there's really no need to worry. But there is. We have to work as human shields for people who don't have the immune systems we do. So please, even if you're young and healthy and you know or have good reason to believe that this sickness wouldn't be that bad for you, wash your hands, try not to get sick, practice all the social distancing techniques that are being recommended, and don't get other people sick. They need you.
For my rant, Donald Trump has gone through his life believing that everything was about him. And the presidency has been bad for his mental state in that when you're the president of the United States, a lot of things really are about you. And so it has only reinforced that idea. And so when he sees something like the coronavirus epidemic come along, he views it through the lens of himself, what it means for his reelection prospects. When he sees the stock market tanking, he thinks that the media is talking too much about this and scaring people too much because they don't want him to win reelection. This is fundamentally not about the president, but it will be about what the president does. Choices that he will make will have big effects on life in the United States and, frankly, will have big effects on his own reelection, which is what I find so weird and self-defeating about the way that he has approached this crisis, making short-term choices, trying to push the stock market up in the short term, trying to control short-term news cycles. The course of this outbreak is going to ultimately control the news cycles, stock market performance, economic performance, the number of people who die, the broad social effects that this will have in the United States. And so if he wants to win again, if he wants even to act from a position of naked self-interest here, he should be behaving very differently, recognizing that this is not fundamentally about him and that he needs to treat it as a real external problem if he hopes to protect himself from the negative consequences. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Ezra Klein, and Donald McNeil. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.